KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We've already cut down to the bone, so we could keep the prices low for our customers.
American companies are changing their business plans to deal with new tariffs. We'll hear from grocery stores that import products from Asia.
Today is Monday, April 7th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, Israel's leader Benjamin Netanyahu visits the White House.
And some of Trump's closest advisors support a political movement that encourages Americans to have more kids.
The United States has low fertility right now. Up until the Great Recession, we were sort of humming along, you know, right around 2 kids per person.
So why did the Trump administration recently eliminate a team in charge of researching IVF?
Also, Alex Ovechkin beats a hockey record that stood for decades.
I'm probably going to need a couple more days, so maybe a couple weeks to realize what does it mean to be number one. But all I can say, I'm very proud.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump hosted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today and again talked about how he thinks the U.S. should control Gaza. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Trump has been floating the idea since coming to office.
Netanyahu's visit comes just weeks after the Israeli military resumed a major ground offensive in Gaza, shattering hopes that a ceasefire would be extended to get more hostages out. Trump is talking about a new ceasefire and his vision for Gaza.
I think it's an incredible piece of important real estate, and I think it's something that we would be involved in, but, you know, having a peace force like the United States there, controlling and owning the Gaza Strip would be a good thing.
Trump says Palestinians should be, in his words, moved around to different countries to make Gaza a, quote, freedom zone. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Supreme Court today ordered a brief administrative stay, allowing it time to consider legal questions presented by the mistaken deportation of a U.S. immigrant living under a judicial order of protected status in the U.S. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Trump administration admits that it mistakenly deported Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an El Salvadoran citizen who's been living in the United States for almost 15 years. The administration now says the deportation was an error, but that it is under no obligation to get him released from a notorious prison in El Salvador and return to his wife and son in the U.S. A federal judge in Maryland ordered the government to do just that by midnight tonight, but the Trump administration appealed to the high court. And this afternoon, Chief Justice John Roberts issued a brief administrative stay to allow the justices time to consider the issues in the case. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks won wildly today as investors look for signs of a possible ceasefire in President Trump's trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Trump administration is sending conflicting signals about where trade policy might be going.
Stocks have mostly nosedived in the U.S. and around the world since President Trump announced his sweeping tariffs last week. But domestic stocks briefly rallied on hopes the administration might be willing to suspend some of those tariffs as it negotiates with other countries. President Trump spoke by telephone with Japan's prime minister, and the head of the European Commission said her side is always ready to make a good deal. The short-lived rally is a sign of just how desperate many investors are for some relief from the tariffs, which threaten to raise prices and slow economic growth. Trump is warning of even higher tariffs on imports from China if that country moves forward with its own taxes on U.S. exports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
That rally mostly fizzled. The Dow was down 349 points today. You're listening to NPR. President Trump says the U.S. and Iran are participating in direct talks over the Middle Eastern country's nuclear program. Trump saying, quote, we are having talks with Iran and they've begun and will go on Saturday. We'll have a very big meeting and we'll see what can happen. Trump's remarks come as Russia, China, and Iran were slated to hold consultations at the expert level on Iran's disputed nuclear program. Trump has repeatedly threatened to bomb Iran unless it comes to an agreement with Washington. The Trump administration is forming a special team to investigate complaints against transgender athletes. The government says it is receiving an increasing number of complaints from people who don't want transgender athletes in girls and women's sports. NPR's Kristen Wright reports.
The Justice Department and the Department of Education are forming the Title IX Special Investigations Team. The government says the unit will streamline complaints, speed up investigations, and resolve cases faster. Education Secretary Linda McMahon made the announcement on X.
The establishment of this team will benefit women and girls across this nation who have been subjected to discrimination and indignity in their educational activities.
McMahon says the team will address a, quote, staggering number of complaints. This as the Education Department was recently gutted to half its size. President Trump issued an executive order in February banning transgender athletes from women's sports. But critics say these athletes make up only a handful of players on teams. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
Crude oil futures prices continue to slide today amidst ongoing global market jitters. Oil down $1.29 a barrel to $60.70 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. It's been another chaotic day in stock markets as the world tries to game out the impact of President Trump's tariffs. White House officials say they've been getting a lot of calls from world leaders about them.
We have many, many countries that are coming to negotiate deals with us, and they're going to be fair deals. And in certain cases, they're going to be paying substantial tariffs. They'll be fair deals. As you know, I spoke this morning with the Prime Minister of Japan, and we had a very good conversation.
And today, President Trump met with one world leader in person, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez was in the Oval Office for part of that meeting and joins me now. Hi, Franco.
Hey, Juana.
So, Franco, tell us, what did the two leaders talk about in terms of tariffs?
Well, Netanyahu, in the beginning, promised to eliminate trade deficits with the U.S. as well as trade barriers. You know, on the big list of tariff countries, Trump actually imposed a 17% tariff on Israel that Netanyahu made very clear that he wants to address. And Trump used the prime minister's proposal to cut trade barriers as an example of how the U.S. is forcing countries to come to the table and try to negotiate. Now, Trump would not say, however, whether he would lower the tariffs on Israel, but he did kind of tease a new trade arrangement. Trump also used the opportunity to attack others that he said have been unfair to the U.S., such as the European Union. He said an offer by the EU to cut tariffs against the U.S. on autos and other industrial goods was just not good enough. He very pointedly said that the EU needs to do much more, and he said a key thing that they need to do is buy U.S. energy.
Tell us who else President Trump's been talking to today.
Well, as you noted earlier, President Trump also spoke to Japan's prime minister today, and his Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, said it was a constructive conversation. The administration is planning to put a 24% tariff on Japanese auto parts and other goods from the country. Bessent said on social media that he and the U.S. trade representative would open talks with their Japanese counterparts on trade barriers and currency issues. Trump said that talks are going well, and here's how he described it.
We are making tremendous progress with a lot of countries, and the countries that really took advantage of us are now saying, please negotiate. You know why? Because they're getting beaten badly because of what's happening. They're getting beaten badly. They're being devalued as countries.
Now, Juana, this follows similar conversations over the weekend with Vietnam, which Trump plans to impose a 46% tariff. The U.S. is the biggest market for Vietnam goods. A big chunk, for example, of Nike gear comes from Vietnam. And Vietnam is very eager to delay the start of the tariffs with these talks.
And Franco, the market is just in turmoil. How's the president reacting to that?
Yeah, he nodded to some of that turmoil and the political risk that he's taking on as he pursues his vision. But he insists that the U.S. only has one shot to do this.
Nobody but me would do this. You know, it would be nice to serve a nice, easy term. But we have an opportunity to change the fabric of our country. We have an opportunity to reset the table on trade.
Yeah, he's not backing down. He's actually doubling down. You know, he threatened to go even harder on China after China threatened to retaliate with more tariffs against the U.S. At the same time, he's also trying to downplay the economic impacts in the U.S., touting lower oil prices and lower interest rates.
I want to go back, if we can, to today's meeting for a second. On any other day, a meeting between these two leaders would be making headlines because of talks on the war in Gaza. Tell us what they said about that today.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, last time they met, Trump proposed moving Palestinians out of Gaza and turning it into a kind of Riviera kind of property. He repeated some of that today, saying it would be good if the U.S. had control of the Gaza Strip. I'll tell you, I watched as Netanyahu kind of turned his head to look at his aides as Trump was talking about this. Trump also made some news when he came to Iran. He said that the U.S. would have direct talks with Iran aimed at curbing its nuclear ambitions starting this weekend on Saturday. Trump wouldn't say where those talks would be or how they would be involved, but that is something we'll be watching very closely.
NPR's Franco Ordonez at the White House. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you.
We have news of two major developments from the Supreme Court involving the Trump administration's deportation efforts. This evening, the justices backed the Trump administration in its efforts to continue deporting what it says are Venezuelan gang members under the controversial Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The court found that the men challenging removals should have contested their arrests in the districts where they were detained, in Texas, instead of Washington, D.C. The second action by the court came in the case of a Maryland man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador. The administration admits deporting Kilmar Abrego Garcia in error. A lower court had ordered that he be brought back to the U.S. by tonight, but the Supreme Court today issued a stay, giving the White House a temporary reprieve. We'll have more in another part of the show about the court's action on the ongoing deportation effort, and NPR's Joel Rose is here to talk about the Abrego Garcia case. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Ari.
Tell us about what the Supreme Court said today.
The Supreme Court issued an administrative stay that temporarily blocks a lower court order from federal judge Paula Zinis, who heard arguments in the case last Friday. The Trump administration has conceded that Kilmar Abrego Garcia was deported by mistake because of what they describe as an administrative error. Abrego Garcia had been living in Maryland for over a decade. He has a form of legal protection that should have prevented his deportation to El Salvador. In spite of that, ICE officers arrested Abrego Garcia last month, and a few days later he was deported to a Salvadoran mega prison, along with hundreds of other men accused of being gang members. But the Justice Department argues there is nothing they can do now because Abrego Garcia is already out of the U.S. Judge Zinis rejected that argument, and the Trump administration quickly appealed to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and did not even wait for a decision there before also appealing to the Supreme Court.
And so what role did the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court play here?
Well, the Fourth Circuit sided very much with Judge Zinis, and it was not a close call. The three-judge panel was unanimous. One judge wrote, quote, "There is no question that the government screwed up here." Another said the Trump administration had no legal authority to, quote, "snatch Abrego Garcia off the street," and called the Trump administration's arguments to the contrary unconscionable.
And what's the latest from the Trump administration on this?
They are not backing down. The Trump administration asked the Supreme Court to intervene, accusing Judge Zinis of trying to seize control over foreign relations, and asked the High Court to vacate or at least postpone her order. The White House insists that Abrego Garcia is a member of the Salvadoran gang MS-13. Here is Tricia McLaughlin, the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security, speaking yesterday on this program.
There's been multiple immigration judges who have reviewed evidence that he's an MS-13 member and confirmed doing so. They affirmed his dangerousness and dismissed his appeal.
It is true that an immigration judge denied bond for Abrego Garcia based on gang allegations. But after a full evidentiary hearing, another immigration judge granted him a lawful status known as withholding of removal in 2019, and immigration authorities did not appeal that decision. Abrego Garcia's lawyers say he has no criminal record in any country, And they say the gang allegation is based largely on a confidential informant who accused Abrego Garcia of being a member of the gang in New York, which is a state where he never lived.
And what is his family saying about the case?
Abrego Garcia's wife, Jennifer Vasquez Sura, spoke at a rally for him last Friday in Maryland. She says the arrest has been devastating for her and for their three children, who, by the way, are all U.S. citizens. Here is a bit of what she said on Friday.
Cameron was not just a family man. He was the light of optimism and joy to everyone around him. He glowed with love, not just with me, but for our children, always putting smiles on their faces.
Vasquez says she and her children are doing their best to fight for him. They will now have to wait longer for the Supreme Court to weigh in. This afternoon, the court issued a one-page order signed by Chief Justice John Roberts, asking Abrego Garcia's lawyers to respond by tomorrow.
NPR's Joel Rose, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yesterday afternoon, Washington Capitals star Alex Ovechkin made hockey history. Here's the call from the Monumental Sports Network.
Ovechkin fires! Score! The chasing days are done! Alex Ovechkin is the greatest goal scorer in the history of the NHL!
With goal number 895, Ovechkin broke the National Hockey League's all-time scoring record, previously held by Wayne Gretzky.
Caps fans have had 20 seasons to celebrate Alex Ovechkin goals, though there's been extra excitement this year as the record got closer. A few weeks ago, our co-host Scott Detrow spoke to fans before the Capitals played the Philadelphia Flyers at home and found that even Flyers fans like Samuel Corkadel were rooting for Ovechkin to break the record.
You know, a lot of players don't really last the way he does. He plays a physical kind of game, swings the body around, hasn't had any real serious injuries. He definitely deserves to be where he is.
I love how he has scored so many goals and is almost the world champion.
Sawyer Walsh came in from Virginia to see that game a few weeks ago with her dad, Matt.
It's going to be a memorable experience, and I hope she looks back on everything associated with Ovechkin and realizing that she was around to see one of the greatest of all time play in our hometown.
The Capitals play-by-play announcer who called Ovechkin's 895th goal is Joe Beninati. He also called Ovechkin's very first goal for the Caps back in October 2005.
Ovechkin fires, he scores! Welcome on board!
You knew that this player was explosive, you knew that he was special, but you figured that there would be some time where he would shrink from the pressure. He never did.
Over nearly two decades, Ovechkin has shown durability to match his talent. Though, at a press conference after yesterday's big game, Ovechkin said he was still taking it all in.
I'm probably going to need a couple more days, or maybe a couple weeks, to realize what does it mean to be number one. But what I can say, I'm very proud.
All of those goals are, of course, in service to a different goal. Ovechkin has once again led his team to a playoff berth, and soon he turns his sights to winning a second Stanley Cup.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The NCAA men's basketball tournament will wrap up tonight, but there is arguably a more important showdown happening in college sports today. This one is in federal court, and it's a landmark case that could reshape college athletics as we know it. NPR's Becky Sullivan has been following the case, and she's here to explain. Hi, Becky.
Hey there.
So, Becky, tell us about this case.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to overstate just how big the changes are that it is set to bring to college sports. The case is called House versus NCAA, or even just the House settlement, basically a few different federal antitrust lawsuits against the NCAA and its biggest conferences like the SEC, the Big Ten, all rolled into one massive landmark class action settlement now that has been in the works for a long time. And so the big thing it would do, the key thing, is it would put into place a revenue sharing scheme where colleges and universities basically could take some of that money that they earn from TV deals for football and basketball, and they could use that to pay players, which would be a first in the history of the NCAA. So obviously that's a huge change for college sports, which were traditionally based around this idea of amateurism.
So, okay, tell us about what happened at today's hearing.
Mm-hmm. So today was the final approval hearing for this proposed settlement, basically the last chance for people to speak up before the judge, federal judge Claudia Wilkin, makes her decision to approve or reject it. Some really compelling objections were raised today, especially about roster sizes. So basically, traditionally, the NCAA didn't have any limits on how big any one team could be. Instead, the limit was how many scholarships a school could hand out for any given sport. So you had like 13 scholarships for men's basketball, 14 scholarships for women's swimming, but no limit on how big the teams could be. So you'd have a lot of kids on like partial scholarships, or you'd have walk-ons who would play on the team with no scholarship at all. That is set to go away right now, as the proposed settlement would call for it. Instead of having scholarship limits, you'd have roster limits. So men's basketball could have 15 spots, women's swim team could have 30 spots, which might sound like an improvement, but actually many teams were already larger than that. And so there's an expectation that hundreds or even thousands of roster spots could disappear over the coming years if the settlement is approved. I talked with Noah Henderson about this. He directs the sports management program at Loyola University Chicago. He said that it really could put current student athletes in a bind. They might have to choose between transferring to a different university or just give up their sport altogether.
All of a sudden, their opportunities are stripped from them. Perhaps they're put in a really challenging spot to either abandon friendships, relationships, academic status they've made, or lose a huge part of their identity. It's a really challenging position.
Becky, how did the judge react to those concerns?
Yeah, you know, the judge really seemed to be paying attention to this stuff, especially during the testimony of a young woman, a high school senior, who spoke in court. She said she's set to be an incoming freshman this fall. She's a runner. She was recruited by a handful of Division I track programs, she said, but when she went to commit to one of them, the next day the coach called her to say, our school is opting into this settlement, and so our team is going to be smaller and we won't have a spot for you. And so, you know, the judge was listening to this, and she was asking lawyers about the possibility of maybe some kind of grandfather clause or some sort of phase-in approach. So it's possible we'll see some modifications to the settlement, or if not, we might end up seeing a whole other lawsuit from kids like this high school senior.
Last thing, Becky, is the settlement going to be approved?
I think almost surely yes, you know, maybe with some of these modifications we're talking about, but if so, it might be likely to go into effect as soon as this summer and fall. Schools are already preparing for it, and it does bring just a whole new set of questions that schools will have to deal with. Who to pay? Which sports are we talking about here? How much do we pay players? And then just a couple weeks ago, a Division I school called St. Francis that had just sent its men's basketball team to March Madness announced that in 2026 it's going to drop down to Division III, in part because of these types of big changes. So we could also just see more of that. Schools basically deciding this is too much to deal with altogether.
That is NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Becky, thanks.
You're welcome.
President Trump has promised to expand access to IVF and recently predicted that he will be known as the, quote, fertilization president. But his administration has eliminated a team at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in charge of researching those fertility treatments. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports.
Among the thousands of federal health agency employees who lost their jobs in recent days was a small group responsible for collecting data and conducting research about the safety and effectiveness of in vitro fertilization at clinics around the country.
We know that IVF is expensive and it's not accessible to everyone. And so our information provides data for patients to make informed decisions.
That's a former CDC employee with knowledge of the team's work. She asked us not to identify her for fear of professional repercussions for speaking out. In documents reviewed by NPR, employees were notified last week that their positions were being eliminated as part of a larger reorganization at the Department of Health and Human Services.
So I think patients will lose out on having the information they need to make choices that are good for their families.
According to that former CDC employee and another source with knowledge of the layoffs, the cuts affected a six-member team based in Atlanta that included experts in epidemiology, statistics, and public health. Barbara Calora, president and CEO of Resolve, the National Infertility Association, says the CDC team was first created in response to a law passed by Congress in the early 1990s in an effort to promote transparency in the growing fertility industry.
Congress wanted patients to know what they were getting when they went to an IVF clinic. Were the results what the clinic said they were? Well, let's look at the data on the CDC website and verify it.
Calora says over the years that data has been used to spot problems and improve health outcomes for both mothers and babies. For example, she says the team's research helped the industry to recognize some of the risks associated with twins, triplets, and even larger multiple births resulting from IVF, leading many providers to recommend patients avoid transferring multiple embryos at once. Sean Tipton of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine says at least some of the data will still be compiled. The industry has been collecting information from IVF clinics for decades. But Tipton says the CDC researchers were able to take that information much farther and present it in a way that both doctors and patients could use.
In order to really make use of it, you have to have people who understand both the medicine behind it and the epidemiology behind it in order to translate that data into meaningful changes that clinicians can bring to their patients.
Tipton says the impact of this recent round of cuts at HHS goes well beyond the team at CDC and could have far-reaching implications.
It certainly looks to me like if you had the misfortune of having women's or reproductive or sexual health anywhere in the name of your department or your title, you were particularly in danger from these cuts.
The dismantling of the CDC team could also run afoul of the federal law that led to its creation, says Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon who sponsored the 1992 legislation.
Collection of the data under the law that I wrote is congressionally mandated. And without staff, you're not going to be able to fulfill the mandate.
Wyden says he struggles to understand why the administration would make these cuts at a time when Trump says he wants to expand access to IVF.
For somebody to say that they want to be the fertilization president and then basically do everything they can to gut the office that was set up in order to do that essential work is absurd.
Officials with the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the CDC, have not responded to repeated requests for comment. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Immigration authorities have detained international students involved in protests in recent weeks.
We gave you a visa to come and study, not to become a social activist that tears up our university campuses.
The First Amendment applies to people regardless of their immigration status.
How secure are the free speech rights of non-citizens? That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the new film, The Friend, Naomi Watts gets top billing, but her four-legged screen partner is also a star.
Great Danes are very sensitive, and they're, you know, we'd have to find the right dog, and you'd have to build the film around the right dog.
The right dog after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump's global tariff war continues to roil both U.S. and foreign markets today. The tariffs are additional taxes the Trump administration is putting on nearly all imported products, affecting a variety of goods from around the world. Today, Israel's prime minister met with President Trump at the White House as his country faces a 17% tariff. Trump told reporters he has no plans on changing his mind about the taxes.
Well, we're not looking at that. We have many, many countries that are coming to negotiate deals with us, and they're going to be fair deals. And in certain cases, they're going to be paying substantial tariffs.
Economists say prices are set to rise on everything from electronics to clothing, cars and parts, and certain grocery items, including beer and wine. A Palestinian-American citizen was killed by Israeli forces over the weekend in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. As NPR's Adil Al-Shawchi tells us, this is the latest death of a U.S. citizen in the West Bank.
The Israeli military said it opened fire towards three people who were endangering drivers by hurling rocks at a highway in the village of Turmus Aya. West Bank health officials said that 14-year-old Palestinian-American Amr Rabia was killed in that operation, and another U.S. citizen was injured. The U.S. State Department did not have immediate comment. Yasser Al-Qam is with the Turmus Aya municipality. He had a message for the U.S. government.
Put some pressure on Netanyahu administration to at least protect its citizens residing in Palestine.
Rabia is the fourth known American citizen killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks finished mixed after another day of mostly losses on Wall Street. The Dow down 349 points. You're listening to NPR News. A new report finds the memoir All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson is now the most challenged book in libraries. NPR's Andrew Limbong has more on the report from the American Library Association.
The ALA has released its annual State of America's Libraries report, listing the most challenged books in school and public libraries. The second most challenged book of 2024 is Maya Kobabe's Genderqueer, and the third is a tie between Stephen Chbosky's The Perks of Being a Wallflower and Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. According to the report, more than 70% of challenges, that is, any attempt to remove or restrict materials, came from organized groups and elected officials, whereas parents and individual libraries users accounted for about 20%. This report comes after President Trump moved to dissolve the Institute of Museum and Library Services last week. That is the agency in charge of sending federal money to libraries. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
At least 23 people are dead after days of severe weather in the South and Midwest. Heavy rains and tornadoes from Texas to Ohio forced utility companies to shut off power and gas as cities deployed sandbags to protect homes and businesses. Forecasters warn flooding could persist for several more days, especially in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Alabama, where many communities are already badly damaged from days of heavy rains and storms. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Billionaire Elon Musk told Fox News recently that falling birth rates keep him up at night. It's a drum he's been beating for years.
The birth rate is very low in almost every country. And unless that changes, civilization will disappear.
Musk is one of the world's most visible beacons of this anxiety. Vice President J.D. Vance also talks about wanting to increase birth rates in the U.S. And it's not just them. There are discussions across the political spectrum about birth rate decline and what it means for the economy. One response to this decline is a cause that's been taken up by the right, and it has a name: pronatalism. Many of its advocates met up recently in Austin, Texas at NatalCon. NPR's Lisa Hagen was there.
Simone Collins, in her thick-rimmed, round glasses, is one of the more visible faces of pronatalism, on purpose.
My whole entire, like, Etsy get-up right now, it's intentionally cringe.
She's here at NatalCon in her signature look, which she describes as techno-Puritan.
There should obviously be more cybernetics in my outfit, but we are combining, like, chunky hipster glasses and a lot of modern equipment with a bonnet and linen clothing.
Think Thanksgiving pilgrim in a school play with a baby strapped to her back.
You'll get to do that soon.
That's one-year-old Industry Americus. Indy's three older siblings are home with neighbors in Pennsylvania. Simone and her husband Malcolm are expecting a fifth child this year, and she's said that she's willing to die in childbirth to have as many kids as possible.
I would rather not do that, but historically, women died in childbirth at roughly similar rates to the rates at which men died protecting their land or country.
The Collinses have made themselves available for profiles in pretty much every major news outlet you can think of.
The number one goal we have is to make everyone universally aware of demographic collapse as a catastrophic issue. Our big focus is primarily on just signaling that this is a culture that values family and kids, and secondarily, taking a regulatory foot off the neck of parents.
Simone and her husband are big fans of Elon Musk. He's famous, he's got 13 kids, and he also tends to talk about falling birth rates in catastrophic terms.
Nothing seems to be turning that around. Humanity is dying.
That's him on Fox News recently. Musk and the Collinses are seen as members of the tech camp of pronatalist advocacy. Venture capitalism, technology like IVF and AI are key parts of their recipe for maximizing human potential via more babies. The Collinses are also very interested in genetic engineering. Another pronatalist camp includes the more religiously motivated and believers in strict gender norms. It's referred to as the trads, as in traditional.
And generally, women should not have careers. They should be socially stigmatized if they have careers.
That's Charles Haywood at the first NatalCon a couple years ago. This year, he's behind the scenes as a sponsor. He made his money as a shampoo magnate. Haywood blames birth rate declines on feminism and the overturning of what he sees as natural hierarchies of gender and race.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its progeny are probably the single most destructive set of laws in American history, and all should be wiped forever from the history of this nation.
So it may seem like a challenge to square a Charles Haywood with a Simone Collins. She's an entrepreneurial woman with a master's degree from Cambridge. But they share a commitment to spaces like NatalCon because they both believe modern culture has stopped prioritizing nuclear families and having kids, which is not really how most demographers describe what's happening. Catherine Benjamin Guzzo is a University of North Carolina sociologist who runs the Carolina Population Center.
The United States has low fertility right now. Up until the Great Recession, we were sort of humming along, you know, right around 2 kids per person.
Then birth rates began to fall, partly because the U.S. succeeded in reducing teen and unintended births. America was actually a couple decades late to the declining fertility trend. It's something that's been happening at different rates all over the world.
And this is true in, you know, Italy, and it's true in Japan, and it's true in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. India has a below replacement fertility rate in some parts.
The theories about why this is happening are pretty complicated. But there's also another trend emerging. We're used to thinking of richer, more educated people having fewer children than the poor and working class. Recent research shows that tendency has actually started to reverse in many countries, including the US. Guzzo says surveys show most people want kids. But nowadays, in this very competitive world, they have a vision of what being a good parent means. A stable home, income, a partner, hope about the future.
People are not being irrational and selfish when they're deciding not to have children. People are making a series of decisions to not have a child now, maybe in the future. And then that keeps happening because we aren't giving people the societal supports to meet their visions of having a good parent.
For her, that should include things like more government funding for healthcare, affordable housing, schools, childcare, addressing climate change. But many pronatalists, including NatalCon's organizer Kevin Dolan, see their biggest allies as the folks in the White House right now. Here's Dolan speaking at the conference over lunch.
But the topic of demographic decline clearly matters to Elon Musk, J.D. Vance, and many others in the Trump administration, which means that the great ideas developed here can get a hearing that would not have been possible last year.
Dolan left his data science job in 2021 after his anonymous Twitter account was exposed. Among other things, he'd used it to promote the racist notion that white men are superior to other races and women. After getting doxxed, Dolan continued sharing his thoughts about how society should be ordered on his podcast.
We're expected to lie about the existence of these hierarchies all of the time. And if our goal is to rehabilitate hierarchies of nature, then the best place to start is the most fundamental natural hierarchies, which are found in the family. And that brings us back to where we started with selective breeding.
Matthew McManus is a lecturer at the University of Michigan and an expert on the modern hard right writers Dolan takes inspiration from.
The idea is essentially that our society has become excessively effeminate, weak, compassionate, and what they want to do is breed or elevate an aristocratic class that's going to be masculine, violent, not necessarily motivated by, let's call it, empathy.
For these thinkers, restoring this masculine culture means feminism and multicultural democracy need to be rooted out.
Women are to be subordinated to men, largely going to be responsible for managing the household, although with no real particular authority. And of course, they're going to have an awful lot of children.
It's not explicit on the NatalCon stage, but part of Dolan's vision for the conference is to help build this world where men like him can't be doxxed because they'll be in power. Dolan says his conference is nonpartisan, and he invites speakers who say stuff like this.
We don't really want to market natalism to the progressive feminists. The people maxing out their fertility should be people, ideally, who won't raise their children to be gender-neutral furries who want to join Antifa one day.
That's a speech from the first NatalCon. It's a writer who goes by the pseudonym Peachy Keenan. Her work is published by a company that sells books arguing black people are inherently more criminal and less intelligent than white people. That publisher, Passage Press, sponsored NatalCon this year, and its founder was a featured speaker. These are some of the elements united under the banner of pronatalism. They don't all agree on how to boost birth rates, but 2 years after the first NatalCon, this is a movement that's much closer to power than it used to be. Lisa Hagen, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump's sweeping tariffs are underway. Among the businesses especially worried are Asian grocery stores, which heavily depend on imported goods. NPR's Juliana Kim traveled up and down Northern Virginia to talk to grocery store owners about how they're navigating this moment. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Juliana, tell us what you've been hearing from these grocery store owners.
Yeah, so I visited Korean, Filipino, and South Asian markets the other day, and all the owners expressed the same emotions. I mean, worry, dread, shock. Alvin Lee, who's the president of an international supermarket chain, Lotte Plaza Market, told it to me like this.
Just stunned by the breadth and the amount and the speed of the tariffs.
You know, at these grocery stores, nearly all their products are imported from overseas, and they're also coming from countries expected to be hit with some of the highest reciprocal tariffs, ranging from 17% for the Philippines to 46% for Vietnam. And then there's China, which is facing an additional 34% in tariffs, bringing the overall rate to 54%, and it may be possibly higher with today's threats.
Juliana, do these grocers know what they're going to do if imports get more expensive?
Lee told me that some of his suppliers are already planning to raise prices. You know, he's hoping they'll be willing to split some of the burden on tariff costs in order to keep prices affordable for customers. The thing is, these stores aren't just popular because they offer unique foods. They still need to be competitive on price, and that's been increasingly tough to do. Lee told me his grocery chain has already been operating on tight margins for years due to rising labor costs and energy costs.
We've already cut down to the bone so we could keep the prices low for our customers.
And it's not just Lee. I heard the same thing from other store owners.
So do you think the tariffs might threaten the future of some of these grocery stores?
Unfortunately, yeah. You know, if these grocery stores have to raise prices again, the owners of smaller shops in particular worry whether their businesses can survive. I spoke with the manager of a small South Asian grocery store in Falls Church, Virginia, that's been around for almost 18 years. You know, despite being near a big Harris Teeter, the store is often busy with loyal customers who are attracted to their sweets and fresh fish directly from Bangladesh.
Some customers come in and their children are like, oh my gosh, this is just like Bangladesh.
That was Dola Hussein. She's 19 and her dad owns Pak Bangla Bazaar. And the shop not only means a lot to her customers, but also to her family. You know, this is their main source of income and what Dola's dad hopes will be his legacy.
Well, do you know how the customers of these grocery stores are feeling?
They're also stressed. I mean, this is coming at a time when customers across the board have been feeling the pinch when they go to the grocery store. But what was interesting to hear is that despite the possibility of higher tariffs, some shoppers are committed to supporting their local businesses. That's what Lina Lay told my colleague Emma Bowman outside of Yamasushi Marketplace in Los Angeles.
We have to adjust our lifestyle with everything, but at the same time, I don't want to not support our community and then losing all these, you know, mom and pop stores.
It's why when Lay's kids earned a lunchtime treat, she chose to get sushi at Yama.
NPR's Juliana Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. We just wrapped the most deadly winter on record for commercial honeybees in the U.S. They not only make honey, they also pollinate more than 100 U.S. crops here for a total of $18 billion in agricultural revenue. KVPR's Carrie Klein reports from Central California, where the bee industry is scrambling to recover from these sudden massive losses.
Tucked away on the outskirts of the city of Visalia is a honey farm. It's got chickens, pet cats, and lots of bees.
How many bees do you think are in the air right here right now?
30,000 maybe?
David Bradshaw has been a commercial beekeeper for 50 years. His bees pollinate almonds, avocados, kiwis, and olives. He also sells honey. But this past winter, something strange started happening at his bee boxes.
You're expecting a lot of bee activity, bees flying in and out, collecting pollen, nectar, and you know, there's like no activity. And as you open the box, there's no bees.
Some of his bees had deformed wings. Others were dead or just gone.
You try to clean it up as it comes in, but you know, pretty soon it was like overwhelming. We just couldn't keep up with the amount of dead hives coming in.
Of the 1,800 hives he started with last fall, just 320 survived the winter.
You know, it's like, what did I do wrong? I mean, I'm a very bad steward of my bees. You know, it really hurts.
But this didn't just happen to Bradshaw. Starting in January, bee researcher Danielle Downey says beekeepers all over the country were calling bee scientists in a panic.
So it was like the bees were slipping through their fingers in days.
Downey runs a nonprofit research organization called Project Apis M. It's named after a species of honeybee. Her group surveyed the majority of the nation's commercial beekeepers and found they lost an average of 62% of their hives just this winter.
These are the highest losses ever recorded.
According to the USDA, for the past few decades, bees have struggled with what's called colony collapse disorder. Scientists haven't been able to identify a single cause. They say pesticides and a parasite known as varroa mites could play a role. That disorder peaked around 20 years ago, but annual deaths of around 30% of commercial bees are still considered normal. So why so many more losses this year? Downey says they don't know yet.
Is there potentially a new virus? There's resistance to the compounds that kill the mites. There's always a concern about pesticide exposures.
Government scientists are analyzing samples of bees, larvae, and honey to try to figure out what happened. But Downey says the Trump administration's cuts to the federal workforce have slowed this work down.
The USDA scientists that we work with on these things who have been heroically showing up to help us in this crisis, they're in their own crisis, watching their friends get fired and worried for their own jobs.
The USDA didn't answer questions about whether employees at its bee labs were fired, but said in an emailed statement that scientists are working to identify the source of the die-offs.
This is a smoker, and smoke has a calming effect on the bees.
Dustin Reeder is a commercial beekeeper in Tarabella, California. He's also a bee broker, trucking in bee boxes from all over the country to pollinate California almonds, then stone fruit. Some move on to Washington apples and canola flowers in North Dakota. Even with so many losses, Reeder says he has scrounged together all the bees his clients have needed so far, but the experience has been grueling.
This year, I was working at least 20 hours a day. I was not able to come home at night. I stayed in my truck and I'd get a few hours of sleep and I'd keep going.
Farmers and trade organizations say it's too early to tell what these losses will mean for ag. But Project Apis M estimates beekeepers are poised to lose hundreds of millions of dollars. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Klein in California's Central Valley.
A new film called The Friend tells a story of two creatures who lose someone they love and find each other. She's a writer. He's a dog. Naomi Watts gets top billing, but her screen partner is also a star. Diane Orson of Connecticut Public Radio brings us the story of a leading actress in the new, quote, Cary Grant of dogs, as one of the filmmakers calls him.
As The Friend opens, Iris is grieving. Her closest friend and mentor has died and bequeathed to her his beloved Great Dane Apollo.
I've imagined it so many times. Now, among all the other questions certain to have come to you was, what will happen to the dog?
She lives alone in a tiny apartment in New York City that won't allow animals. And it's not like she can hide Apollo from her superintendent. He's about the size of a small pony.
There are no dogs allowed.
It's just until I can find
No,
not even temporary.
At a press event, Naomi Watts describes her co-star as sensitive and responsive. Right now, he's sprawled out on the floor.
When I started to cry on him, he is suddenly, what can I do to fix this? Or something's wrong.
The movie's based on the novel by Sigrid Nunez. The book's cover features a Harlequin Great Dane, white with black spots. And the filmmakers wanted that dog for the film. That dog was discovered by theatrical animal trainer Bill Berlone.
When I read the script, I called the filmmakers back and said, you can't make this movie the way you've written it.
Berlone's the only animal handler who's ever won a Tony Award. He knew the breed could be tricky to work with.
Great Danes are very sensitive, and they're, you know, we'd have to find the right dog, and you'd have to build the film around the right dog.
The filmmakers were adamant. It had to be a visibly male Great Dane who could appear soulful, expressive, and funny. Berlone contacted hundreds of breeders. He poured through headshots, traveled nationwide. Finally, he rolled into Iowa, and there was Bing. This gentle giant had it all: regal bearing, mournful expression, testicles intact, and humanely trained.
And I turned to the filmmakers and said, if you don't hire this dog, I'm going to hire him and take him to New York. And so that's how we found him.
Going to make a star.
I know, exactly, because he had all those qualities above and beyond.
He even sings on cue.
Can you woo woo?
Oh, woo. When Berlone works on Broadway, he teaches performers to become trainers. Stage dogs don't act, he says. They live in real time. Their attention should be on stage and not on a handler in the wings. But movies are different, more tricks. Berlone wanted Bing's connection with Watts to be real. He asked if they could approach the friend like a piece of theater. Watts agreed.
I needed to start on a training path, and I'm a dog person. I'm not squeamish, slobber all over me, you know, like whatever.
Still, it was complicated.
Because he's twice my size, nearly. He weighs 150 pounds. He's incredibly strong.
Watts and Bing spent several weeks getting to know each other. And she says once cameras started rolling, they got gold.
There was something really beautiful about experiencing grief with another species. It was very healing.
Near the close of the film, we again hear Iris thinking about what her dog was like before she met him.
Not to have known you as a frisky young dog, to have missed your entire puppyhood. I don't feel just sad, I feel cheated.
But audiences won't. The friend has opened to glowing reviews. For NPR News, I'm Diane Orson.
Good boy, babe.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.